following teleconference is recorded for Robert Greenstein, Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, Tuesday, October 20th, 2015, 12:30 p.m. Central Time. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your patience in holding. We now have your speakers in conference. Please be aware that each of your lines is in a listen-only mode. At the conclusion of today's presentation, we will open the floor for questions. At that time, instructions will be given as to the procedure to follow if you would like to ask a question. It is now my pleasure to turn today's conference over to Robert Greenstein. Sir, you may begin.
Good afternoon, everyone. We're very pleased to have with us today two of the nation's most preeminent macroeconomists, Marc Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytics and co-founder of economy.com, and Alan Blinder, professor of economics and public affairs at Princeton and the former vice chair of the Federal Reserve. Mark and Alan are the authors of what I regard as one of the most important papers in economic policy in quite some time. This is a paper, which we at the Center commissioned, that examines in depth the impact of the full range of options taken to address the financial crisis and the Great Recession, from TARP and the auto bailouts to Federal Reserve policies to the stimulus bills that Congress passed. And this is particularly important because, of course, we will sooner or later have another recession. We may have another financial crisis. And it's critical that we learn lessons from the period we've just been through, and that's precisely what this paper does. Also joining us here today is Jared Bernstein, senior fellow at the Center and director of the Center's Full Employment Project. So we're going to hear first from Mark and then from Alan, and then we're going to go directly to your questions. Mark Zandi.
Thank you, Bob. Thanks for those very kind words. I appreciate that. And I want to thank you and Jared and the Center for the support and sponsorship of this work. And I also want to thank Alan for being a wonderful collaborator. It's been a very rewarding and a great, tremendous experience. The work that we've done, broadly speaking, has had two objectives. The first is to assess the policy response in its totality to the financial crisis and the Great Recession. And this is, in a sense, a reprise of the work that Alan and I did back in 2010. Of course, we're fortunate enough now that we have some history between us and that time, and a lot more data points and better tools, better models, and thus we thought that it would be important to go back and take another look at this and take another crack at it and see if our work in 2010 holds up and what else we could learn. So that was objective number one. And then objective number two was to tease out from our results and the experience of the past 7 years since the crisis and the recession, what we've learned that we can use in ensuring that we don't get into a similar mess in the future, and if we do have future crises, which I'm sure we will, that policymakers take the right lessons from what we've just experienced so that they can respond to that crisis in a more effective way and ensure that we don't suffer the same kind of economic pain that we did. So those were the two key objectives. I'll talk to the first, and then I'll turn it over to Alan to talk to the second objective. With regard to the efficacy of the policy response to the financial crisis, Great Recession, in its totality, and when I say totality, there were many aspects to the response, but in its totality, I think it was a resounding success. Now, that sounds a little odd. We, of course, have suffered significantly. At the worst of the downturn back in 2009 and early 2010, the unemployment rate topped out at 10%. We came into the period with a sub 5% unemployment rate that topped out at 10%. So it was indeed a great recession, a very painful time. We're still not completely free of it. The economy is normalizing, but we're still not quite at full employment. And, of course, policy hasn't normalized. The Federal Reserve has yet to even begin raising interest rates. So the long shadow of the Great Recession still hangs over us. So it was a very difficult time. But our work does show that if not for the policy response, the recession would have been, as Alan is fond of saying, the Great Depression 2.0. It would have been meaningfully more severe than what we suffered through. In fact, just to give you context, the unemployment rate in actuality did peak out at 10% in early 2010, late 2009, early 2010. By our calculation, our work, we find that the unemployment rate without the policy response would have topped out at a eye-popping 16%. The recession would have been twice as long, the job loss GDP impacts at least twice as severe, the budget deficit, while massive, approaching 10% of GDP in actuality, would have been double that. It would have gone down in history as another depression. So taken together, all the things that policymakers did, and again, it was many things, it was a success. Looking at the policy response, in broad terms, there are three types of policy efforts. First was the effort to stabilize the financial system. There are many players involved here, including the Federal Reserve, the FDIC, other regulatory agencies, Congress, the administration. I think the most important point coming out of this effort is that stabilizing the financial system, in a sense, bailing out the banking system and the system more broadly, was a necessary condition for stabilizing the economy and jumpstarting an economic recovery. Without that effort, without stabilizing Wall Street, so to speak, Main Street would take a lot longer for Main Street to find the bottom and to get up and running. Now, there were many aspects to the effort to stabilize the financial system. I'll just name a few that are kind of at the top of my list in terms of effectiveness. I think first and foremost was the Federal Reserve's efforts to provide liquidity to the financial system through an array of different liquidity provisions that were, in a sense, invented on the fly in real time, helping different parts of the system, commercial paper market, money market, money markets, asset-backed securities markets, all were provided liquidity. Expansion of swap lines to help with liquidity of global economies and central banks, all of that very important. In fact, just to give you a sense of the magnitude, at the peak of the liquidity provisions, it was equal to about $1.5 trillion on the Fed's balance sheet. The beauty of it, though, was that as the system found its footing, liquidity revived, those special liquidity provisions quickly evaporated, and it wasn't but a year or two after the crisis that they no longer were playing a role. FDIC also played a key role in increasing deposit insurance limits. And, you know, one effort the FDIC doesn't get much credit for, which I think is important, is the bank debt guarantee helped to stabilize the funding needs of the banking system and really calm nerves. And finally, of course, something that all of us, I think, agree was quite important, still important to this day, is the bank stress testing process and recapitalization of the banking system, which I'll point out was much more effective than, I think, what happened in the UK, where they nationalized much of their banking system, and it's taken a lot longer for them to extricate themselves from the banking system, and our approach was much better. Of course, we didn't do that for every institution. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were effectively nationalized, and then we're still trying to figure that one out. The second broad set of policies that were very supportive and helpful were related to fiscal policy, and lots of, again, moving parts here are very controversial, but I think our work clearly shows that the fiscal stimulus efforts, the temporary increase in government spending, cuts in taxes were very effective. The Recovery Act, the most controversial stimulus passed in February of 2009, was very instrumental in ending the recession, jumpstarting a recovery. The recession ended only a few months after the Recovery Act in June of 2009, and the first job increases began a year later in February of 2010. So I don't think that's any accident. There's a lot of criticism of, you know, sort of some of the other policy efforts, fiscal policy efforts, housing tax credits, cash for clunkers for the auto industry. And, you know, I think they weren't quite as effective, efficacious as some of the other things that were done, but I think they played a key role and goes to another very important point, that when you're in crises, it's important to try lots of things. You know, some things will work, some things won't, at least as well. But it is important to be and vital to be creative in the policy response. And things like cash for clunkers and first-time home buyer tax credits, I think, were in that vein and did help. And then finally, the third grouping of policy efforts was monetary policy, zero interest rates, QE, quantitative easing, also quite controversial. But I think, again, our work shows, I think, quite clearly that QE was very much a net positive for the economy. Certainly some downsides, and the script on this is still being written, but I think at least up to this point in time, it's clear that it did help to lower long-term interest rates, support asset prices, and support economic growth, and we go through that in some detail. One other quick point about the policy response. The combination of all of the various policy efforts was very, very important. If you take any one of the policy responses in isolation, it had an impact, but these impacts, when the policies are taken together, were amplified each other. They were self-supporting, and thus it highlights the importance of using policy broadly to combat crises, restore stability in the system, and jumpstart recovery, that the policy response is more than the sum of the parts, that there is additional juice that's provided by this self-supporting nature of it. Now, finally, I'm just going to say there obviously were some policy efforts that fell short of expectations and weren't as successful as they could have been, should have been. I think there is a fair amount of reasonable criticism with regard to policy leading up to the crisis, and in my view, it was several policy mistakes that contributed to the severity of the crisis, and I think we've learned from that, and Dodd-Frank is an effort to address those mistakes, but I think that's important to recognize. And I do think, finally, that the one place where I think policy did fall disappointingly short was with regard to housing policy. Obviously a very complex problem with lots of moving parts. It wouldn't be easy to address the housing market's problems. No argument there. But I think the efforts that were put in place were, they did fall short and could have been better designed and more effective. But all in all, bottom line, this was a success. What policymakers did was they should get a lot of credit for it, and I think we can draw a lot of good lessons from it. So with that, I'll stop, and then I'll turn the conversation over to Alan. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark, and let me just add my thanks, including, since we're being nice to each other, to Mark, most of the hard work on this paper. Now, I want to just start at a point that Mark touched upon in different ways several times, which is this. If you're in a key policymaker's chair when something like this or remotely like this happens, you are faced with titanic levels and a variety of uncertainties. So it's not like there's a menu that you just pick up and choose. This is what you do in circumstance 27. And if the biggest lesson, I think, from this is that in a situation like that, it makes sense for policymakers to err on the side of too much rather than too little. So that's a bigger stimulus rather than a smaller stimulus, that's more QE rather than less QE, and a whole variety of things like that, knowing that you don't know the perfection point, the exact amount that will be just enough to cure the problem and not too much to create some other problems. And that's because the risks are very asymmetric. Now, what that leads to is a corollary, and then I want to elaborate on the corollary, which is it's a big mistake for the government, whether we're talking about the Congress, the administration, or the financial authorities led by the Fed, to do things today that will make it harder for the next round of the next group of policymakers to cope with the next crisis. And I'll give you one concrete example of that, and then I want to take off from that point, which is a regrettable, you know, not catastrophic, but a regrettable piece of Dodd-Frank was to make it harder for the Federal Reserve to serve as a lender of last resort in the crisis. Congress shouldn't have done that. The Fed was not happy to see that done. There are probably ways around it, but it just wasn't a very smart thing to do unless you think that's the only crisis we'll ever face. Now, what I want to do in the rest of my 6 minutes or whatever is basically to focus on some of the wrong lessons that people would like us to learn from this and emphasize that they're wrong, and often that the correct lesson is just the opposite. So start with the moral hazard issue. There's all class of people that, first of all, everybody agrees that moral hazard is a potential problem when you bail people out, and we'd rather not do it. There's no dispute about that. But the question is, how big are those costs? And as we put in the paper, is moral hazard really a showstopper, or are there times, as many people would like you to believe, or are there times when you should sort of say, all right, I take that as a cost of what we're going to do, but we're going to do it anyway because of the clear and present danger to the whole economy? And there were a number of cases as this crisis unfolded that were of that nature. So we think on a really important lesson is not to think of moral hazard as a showstopper, that is, thou shalt not go where moral hazard lurks, but rather as a trade-off. Yes, it's a bad thing. We wish we didn't have to do it. But there may be good, under extreme circumstances, there may be good reason to live with the moral hazard. And I think that's a very important lesson. Second wrong lesson that people are still trying to get us to learn, it's almost impossible for me to understand how people maintain this, but some people do, is the anti-Keynesian message that fiscal stimulus doesn't do any good for the economy, just in terms of growth, and in some people, as it comes out of some people's mouths, actually has the opposite effect, shrinks the economy rather than expands the economy. I was never able to understand in real time, this is going back to, say, 2009, 10, 11, and I certainly can't understand in retrospect, John Boehner's famous, in some quarters, phrase of job-killing government spending. If you think of that construction, job-killing government spending, when the government spends money, as Keynes said in the 1930s, it's doing one of two things, basically. It's hiring people itself to do work, or it's hiring private contractors, buying things from private firms, who in turn have to hire people to produce whatever it is they produce. How that could kill jobs is beyond me. It may be bad ideas. You may be able to think of better ways to spend money. There are lots of legitimate criticisms of the stimulus package that Congress actually passed, but the notion that it was a job killer is just about as wrong as it could be. So Keynes had that more or less right in the 1930s. Third argument that you hear is that the Federal Reserve, in doing some of these things that Mark mentioned, was going beyond its legal authority, pushing the law to and beyond its breaking point, and maybe even poaching into the realm of Congress, doing quasi-appropriations, not literal, of course, appropriations, but things that look like appropriations, which is putting public money at risk to try in some of these bailouts and liquidity facilities and other things that Mark either mentioned or alluded to. Now, if you read the Federal Reserve Act as it was written then, especially the famous 13.3, Section 13.3, there's no doubt that the Fed stayed within its legal authority. Many people in Congress were shocked to see how much legal authority the Fed actually had, but it stayed within its legal authority, that's for sure. However, it is true that the Fed put taxpayer money at risk in several instances, and that's what I meant by something analogous to an appropriation. It's not literally an appropriation, and in fact, in most of those cases, or almost all of those cases, where the Fed put money at risk, the risk turned out fine, and the taxpayers did not lose money. But it could have gone the other way, and the taxpayers could have lost money, and some people are very unhappy about that. And in particular, that's what I was mentioning at the outset of my little talk, if you want to call it a talk, which is this provision was put into Dodd-Frank to make it harder for the Fed to do things like that, and specifically not to be able to do it for a single company. So you could think about Bear Stearns, you could think about AIG, or you could think about what the Fed might have done but didn't do for Lehman Brothers. That kind of thing is now illegal because of Dodd-Frank, and I think that was a mistake. The fourth lesson that should never be learned, but some people are trying to hammer into our heads constantly, is that the super expansionary policies such as those the Fed has put into place in the context of this crisis and still exist, such as zero interest rates and this tremendous expansion of the balance sheet via QE, will eventually be inflationary. Now, critics were saying that in 2009, 2010, 2011, dot, dot, dot. They're still saying it today. There's been no sign of inflation, and as all of you know, no sign of higher inflation, and as all of you know, the Fed is now trying actually actively to make inflation higher than it is, not lower than it is. And sometimes people forget that this danger was raised back in 2009, 6 years ago. Last point I want to make, I could go on and on with these negative lessons, is there's a bunch of people that would like you to believe that very big policies going in, the Fed now faces a massive and perhaps impossible exit problem. How does it get out? Which it appears to be on the verge of starting with raising interest rates sometime soon, whether it's December or not December. I think we both think, Mark and I think, one missing point in this debate is people forgetting that the Fed has as many bites at this apple as it thinks it needs. It's not like the Fed is going to embark on a policy, like one big policy, like the fiscal stimulus that passed in 2009. The Fed's not going to do that. The Fed is going to have many, many incremental policy tightenings over a protracted period of time, probably measured in years, and any time it feels it's made a mistake, it could always slow down or even reverse something it's already done. So while this exit is complicated and in some sense difficult, I don't think, and Mark and I don't think, it's nearly as difficult as some of the critics say. So the false lesson to learn is that the Fed, in its haste to avoid Great Depression 2.0, got us into an even bigger problem, and they have no idea how to get us out of it. I just think that's wrong. And so let me stop there.
Thank you, Mark and Alan. Operator, we're ready to open the lines for questions.
Thank you, sir. At this time, we'll open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please dial the star key followed by the 1 key on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you'd like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, please dial star 2. Again, to ask a question, dial star 1 now. We'll pause a moment The first question will come from Paul Rosenberg with Salon. Please go ahead.
I know this is outside your area of expertise, but the lack of criminal investigation into criminal responsibility is something that would figure as a kind of reinforcement or picking up of the slack of moral hazard. And if that had been a part of the mix, I think the danger of moral hazard in other areas might have been somewhat mitigated. Do you have any thoughts on that?
This is Alan Bleiner. I'll start on that. Maybe Mark has some thoughts. It's not what we wrote about, of course, but I do have a view on it, which is that it was a big mistake on the part of the Justice Department mainly not to do more prosecutions of individuals. Now, I want to hasten to say doing dumb things is not criminal, but misrepresentations can be criminal depending on details. And the main point, so I very much want to agree with you, is that if you fine a gigantic bank, you know, whatever, $1 billion, $5 billion, you're basically punishing the taxpayers of that bank. You're basically punishing the shareholders of that bank, who almost certainly did nothing wrong. You are not punishing the guilty parties. So I think it was a big mistake, and the next time we shouldn't make this mistake. And to your precise question, yes, I think that would do much more good on the moral hazard front than just finding the bank.
I'll give you my 3 cents. I mean, I agree with what Alan said. I'd say two additional things. First is, I do think while individuals weren't found culpable, institutions were, and financial institutions did pay a heavy price in terms of the penalties they paid, and if you add it up, the costs were in the hundreds of billions of dollars. So I agree that I think the moral hazard concern would have been mitigated and certainly addressed if individuals were held culpable. But it is also the case that the system, the financial system, has paid significant penalties to Fannie Mae, to Freddie Mac, to the FHA, to the DOJ. So I think that should be recognized. The second thing I'd say is, and I say this with less conviction, is I'm not sure it's worth going down that path right now. I mean, here we are 7 years after the crisis. And, you know, even if one could pursue people if there weren't statute of limitations issues, I think it's time to move on. That we need to begin to look forward and get beyond the long shadow of the recession and stop replaying this. And you can kind of feel the ill effects of that in the financial system in that the system isn't quite there yet in terms of providing credit fully, particularly with regard to mortgage lending, first mortgage lending. And that may be in part because of continued concerns about paying that price from the Great Recession. So I wonder if it's not time to move on and look forward. But I do agree that it was a mistake not to pursue individuals for their culpability in terms of the frauds that were committed and likely committed during that period.
Thank you for your question. Again, if you have a question, please dial *1 now.
We'll wait just another minute to see if any of you have questions. If there are no further questions, we will adjourn the call. So if you do have a question, please dial *1 right now.
We have a follow-up question from Paul Rosenberg with Salon. Please go ahead.
Okay. On another tack, I'm wondering about questions of putting this into a historical context, because this wasn't just a unique thing in time. It took place while the whole global economy is, going through an evolutionary process. I wonder if there were any thoughts that you had about impacts in terms of how the economy globally is restructuring itself, any interaction effects that occurred to you or thoughts that you had about that that might somewhat modify lessons going forward or add to them.
Now, Mark might actually disagree with this, but I'm going to take a pretty strong position on this, not an absolute position, and that's that this crisis was very much homegrown, done here in America, made here in America, with minimal foreign influences. Now, I wouldn't go so far as to say zero. One thing that the evolution or changing world economy did is made it easier. This has always happened, but made it easier for our financial institutions to pawn off some of these disgraceful assets on foreign buyers, ranging from foreign financial institutions to private individuals to townships in Norway and a whole variety of buyers, German Landesbanken, that never should have been buying any of this stuff. And the fact that they were there to buy it, I'm talking about subprime mortgages and the derivatives built thereon, it would have been harder to have so much of it out there. But to me, that's a minor qualifier, and the overwhelming majority of the list of causes of this crisis are entirely American.
Yeah, I think I would agree. I guess the only caveat I would say is I think the British were right in there with us. So, the London banking financial system was, hip deep in all of this with the American financial system. Of course, they have a shadow system that is not too dissimilar to our own. And the securitization process there, not quite as developed as here in the U.S., but, pretty well advanced. So, I think the U.K. probably also played a role. And, of course, they paid a heavy price. I mean, the U.K. economy was hurt even more than our own during the downturn. But, yeah, outside of that, I'd say this is pretty much an American-made problem. It goes to a breakdown in the regulatory process here, in the securitization process that was broken at the core, I would agree it's almost entirely an American issue, American-made issue.
I'm showing no further questions at this time. I'll turn it back to Robert Greenstein.
Thank you. If there are no further questions, we will adjourn the call at this time. Thanks particularly to Alan Blinder and Mark Zandi for joining us today. And for this important paper, you can find the paper on the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities website. Thanks, everyone, for joining us today.
Thank you, Bob. Bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference. You may now disconnect your lines. Have a great afternoon.